Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker, speaking to you from my home in Woods Hole. It's Friday, July 10th, and this is our weekly local news roundup. We'll be discussing the week's top stories with colleagues in the print and digital media. Today on the program, we'll be hearing from WCAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff. We'll speak with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, check in with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Marianne Bragg at the Provincetown Banner, Cindy McCormick at the Cape Cod Times, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. We'll speak with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette and hear from Mike Dean up at the State House. The bridges over the Cape Cod Canal, the Bourne and the Sagamore, will belong to the state when they're replaced. WCAI's Jeanette Barnes joins us with that story and more. Hi, Jeanette.
Hi, Steve.
Jeanette, news of this agreement came out over the weekend. It wasn't something we had been looking for or expecting. Tell us about this deal.
Yeah, so the deal says that the Massachusetts Department of Transportation will be the lead agency for the design and rebuilding of both of the bridges, even though it's actually the Army. And then once the bridges are complete, the Army Corps will transfer to the state. The rationale here is it just has a lot more experience with bridge work, and we'll be able to better coordinate the construction with all of the road work that will have to happen around the bridges when they're replaced. Worth noting, though, the memo that they both signed says that funding of the bridges is still a federal responsibility, and that's an estimated $1 billion project.
So the state taking the lead here on the bridges, and then after they're completed, taking over ownership of them, which is a pretty big deal for the Cape. The bridges have always fallen underneath the Army Corps of Engineers, who maintain the canal, too. What did we hear from the state legislatures around this and folks in public office about this deal?
Yeah, so this got a lot of support in Massachusetts from Senators Warren and Markey, from Congressman Keating and Governor Baker. A couple of local people I talked to of interest, Representative Randy Hunt said he supports it, although he says future maintenance costs could lead the state to want to consider tolls down the road, and he is concerned about the maintenance, although the bridges in the short term will be brand new. Maintenance is always an issue. And then Glenn Cannon, who is the assistant town administrator in Bourne, where both of the bridges are located, he seemed quite happy. He said this is really an important moment because of the depth of expertise that DOT has to bring to bear on the bridges.
It's going to be a big project when it happens. All of this is still just preliminary, though, kind of positioning it all and still no idea really about timeline moving forward or even how the feds are going to end up carving out that $1 billion that they need to come up with to pay for the bridges. I want to ask you about another story you covered this week, which is the Cape Cod Reopening Task Force released some numbers about COVID-19 and racial disparity on the Cape. Tell us what we heard from them.
Yes. So unfortunately here, the news is that the rate of infection with COVID-19 for Black people on the Cape is three times higher than it is for white people. The New York Times had to sue the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to get this data because Massachusetts is only releasing the data that's broken down by race for the state as a whole, not for the county. But officials here are saying the reasons for the differences they see on the Cape include things like inadequate health insurance, which reduces access to primary care, the fact that people of color are overrepresented among essential workers, and therefore they're getting exposed to the virus. And then, of course, on the Cape, real estate is always an issue because with the cost of real estate, the cost of housing, people who cannot afford more housing, more expensive housing, tend to live in crowded conditions, and that is a situation where the virus can be easily transmitted. Senator Sear said that we really need to start talking about housing on the Cape as a racial justice issue.
All of those things that you point to there, the housing and the other aspects of this, are really systemic issues and are going to take some addressing by folks at the state level maybe to start to even unpack some of that, it sounds like. But this was the first opportunity to look at these numbers and see that they really reflect a lot of what we've been hearing nationally here on the Cape. That is WCAI's Jeanette Barnes. Jeanette, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks.
Toxic levels of blue-green algae have shown up in 5 ponds across the Cape, according to the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. WCAI's Eve Zuckoff has been reporting on why this is and what it means for pond goers. Hi, Eve.
Hi there, Steve.
Eve, first explain what this risk is all about. What is this algae and why are we seeing it?
Yeah, so normally these blue-green algae blooms, they're also known as cyanobacteria scums. They're actually harmless. They're natural parts of ecosystems, and they just kind of make water look scummy. I think a lot of us have seen them in ponds before. But sometimes what happens and what's happening right now is too many nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus kind of seep into the water bodies, seep into these ponds from septic systems and fertilizers and storm water runoff. And what those nutrients do is they act as fuel for these blue-green algae blooms. They allow them to dominate in the ecosystem and release, ultimately, these dangerous toxins. And they cause, unfortunately, everything from skin irritation to fevers to major organ damage in really high concentrations. And this is not the first time we've seen these toxic algae blooms. They were in ponds last summer as well, and thankfully no one got sick, but they were also in ponds in Michigan last summer, and some dogs actually died after exposure to them.
I understand there's a climate change connection here. Explain that part of it for us.
Yes, that's right. So I said that these blooms are fueled by nutrients, but that's actually only half the picture. The way that these blooms actually start to grow and get a chance to dominate is when the water gets warm, like, you know, many other kinds of bacteria. So that's the right growing environment. So the concern this year is that it's actually just really early to be seeing these blooms become dangerous right now. Ponds have not had a chance to warm up that much yet. We're pretty early in the summer, and we've got a whole summer ahead of us. So we know that because temperatures are rising regionally and globally because of climate change, the question becomes, you know, are these toxins emerging right now and because of an anomaly, or is this the beginning of something troubling ahead for you know, future summers, that as it gets warmer earlier and there are these right growing conditions, we need to be ready for this. So I should say the good news is that there is something we can actually do about this with both when it comes to the nutrient side of it, which is somewhat more important, you know, to reduce risk. One thing people can do going forward is just reducing how much fertilizer they use. They can also consider replacing their septic systems with less leaky systems that reduce how much nitrogen actually gets out. So it's not too bleak a picture yet, this one.
Tell us where the ponds are.
Yeah, so these ponds, really, there are several in Brewster, and there are also several in Falmouth. Walker's Pond and Cliff Pond in Brewster, Mayor's Pond and Deep Pond in Falmouth, and Long Pond in Marston's Mills. But I think it's important to note that there are 1,000 ponds on the Cape. Only 35 of them are monitored by the APCC. So what people really should do is consider checking in with their town boards of health if they know they're going to be swimming in a pond. There are other methods to make sure that you're swimming somewhere safe.
Let's talk about another story you did this week. You reported this week that North Atlantic right whales are officially on the brink of extinction, according to a group. They're not just considered endangered anymore, but critically endangered. What does this actually mean? And we've been reporting on this plight for some years, so why this new classification now?
Yeah, so on Thursday, they were, as you say, officially classified as critically endangered by the International Union for Conservation of Nature. People may have heard of the Red List that they make. They were added to that. And it's the last classification before a species is considered extinct or extinct in the wild. And so really what this is, what this signals, as one scientist with the New England Aquarium told me, is this is an international red flag. This is telling everyone that what we're doing to protect them up until this point is just not enough. So we're not exactly sure why this came out now. We haven't yet heard back from the IUCN, but more likely than not, this is a long time in the making. The total population of these whales has declined by about 15% in the last decade. And just, you know, last month, at the end of last month, yet another male calf was found with clear signs of a vessel strike. He had been struck in the head several times by boats, another time in the tail. Not the first whale that we assume has been, or that we know has been killed this year. It's just a carcass that's been found. Mm-hmm. And that's the direction, unfortunately, that we are still going in.
That is WCAI's Eve Zuckoff joining us. Eve, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
PFAS, cancer-causing chemical contaminants, have been found in the groundwater near Nantucket Airport. Josh Balling from the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror joins us with that story. Hiya, Josh.
Good morning.
Josh, tell us what it is that they've identified there and a little bit more about the details around it.
Sure. They have identified through some well water testing PFAS, the potentially cancer-causing contaminant that's commonly found in fire retardants and particularly in the foam used to fight fires at airports. Earlier this year, an environmental testing firm out of Pennsylvania contracted by the airport began testing the airport wells for the PFAS. And they tested four of the five wells on the site, and three of the four wells came back positive, two of those at levels above what the State Department of Environmental Protection has determined to be safe. The wells don't supply the airport's drinking water. That is on the town's water supply. And in May, that company also started testing residential wells south of the airport for PFAS. It's tested 12 so far. Eight of them have come up positive, six above the DEP threshold. Obviously, residents in the neighborhood are concerned, and they're asking for increased testing both west and southwest of the airport as well. Property owners whose wells have tested positive are being supplied with bottled water from the airport and filtration systems that do eliminate the contaminants. The airport, about 9 months ago, stopped testing the firefighting foam in a way that would leach the chemicals into the groundwater. The foam ended up on the ground and ended up apparently in the groundwater during these tests. The airport is still mandated by the Federal Aviation Administration to use foam in cases of emergency, but they have no record of foam ever actually being used in an aircraft accident. But it certainly, you know, is unfortunately a possibility.
This echoes what's happened on the Vineyard. They found PFAS in the groundwater around the airport there, and then also on the Cape, where firefighting foams have been responsible, or identified as responsible for these contaminants in the groundwater on the Cape. These are typically pretty well concentrated inside of one kind of watershed. Is that right? Is that the case there too?
They are definitely contained to the watershed. The watershed near the airport, however, does stretch again to the south and to the southwest and southeast of the airport. So that's why they've spread the net a little bit in the vicinity of the airport to test for it. The other big issue with PFAS is that it doesn't necessarily dissipate. It lasts for a long time. So it's potentially unclear how long these contaminants have been in the groundwater and been in the wells there. They just don't know that at this point. They're going to continue to test, and the town is also looking at the Wanakamot Water Company is also doing some testing as well.
You also have a story about the first mask compliance fine issued on Nantucket. Tell us about this.
Sure. On the 4th of July, there was a party in a property just outside of downtown Nantucket in the area that is covered by the town's mask compliance order that the Board of Health issued about 10 days ago or so. And those partiers were fined $1,000 by the town's health director for violating that order to wear face masks. The group of about 20 people were outside a home on Atlantic Avenue. They were warned multiple times by Health Director Roberto Santa Maria to wear the face coverings and to reduce the number of people on the property to 10 or less. He said he originally stopped by the property, which overlooks a busy intersection, because he could clearly see people outside in close quarters not wearing masks. He asked them to disband, telling them that there were, you know, more than 10 people on the property, and that was in violation of the state guidelines, and put on masks because they were in the area of that the town order applied to. But after they refused to comply, when he came back a second time, they began to get a little belligerent with him, he said, and that's what led him to issue the fine. He said he's not interested in using fine as enforcement. He'd rather seek compliance through education, but he's not going to stand for that kind of behavior. So overall, he said, though, the compliance has been receptive. The town has COVID education officers who are on the streets reminding people to wear masks, and those, according to the town manager and to the town health director, have been well received. Most people who don't have masks will apologize and put them on. They've also, these officers have been asked, basically instructed not to get into confrontations. If somebody absolutely refuses, they will politely remind them that it is the order, and then to disengage. They're not going to get into a confrontation on the street with somebody who simply absolutely refuses to wear a mask.
Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror. Josh, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're talking about the top local stories of the week with colleagues in the print and digital media. I'm Steve Junker. Chatham has its fish observation pier back, or this fish pier observation deck back. Tim Wood joins us from the Cape Cod Chronicle with the story. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Steve.
Tim, this has been a saga. It seems like we've been talking about this for a couple of years. I think we have.
We have almost, yeah. As you said, it's long awaited. The Fish Pier Observation Deck is the top tourist attraction in town, and it's basically been off limits for 18 months since way back in December 2018 when the deck was closed because it was unsafe. That month, the town issued a contract for a new deck, $1.6 million project that included some new underground fuel tanks as well as the new observation deck. And it was all supposed to be done by Memorial Day 2019. When that deadline rolled around, the underground fuel tank portion of the project was done, but there was nothing standing where the observation deck was supposed to be. It soon became clear that this deck wasn't going to be ready for the summer tourist season, which was a problem. Like I said, it's one of, if not the biggest, one of the biggest tourist attractions in town, attracting, as many as 3,000 people a day down there. And they come to watch fishing boats offload. There are always seals hanging around there looking for scraps. So it's the one place that people know they can see seals up close. And without the deck, people have been, still going to the fish pier, but crowding around work areas, and it's been kind of a problem. Since then, a number of deadlines came and went. The town began issuing what they call liquidated damages, which is essentially fines against the contractor, Shiaba Construction of Walpole. They began issuing those fines in November. And finally, just in time for this 4th of July weekend, the deck finally was completed enough for the town to get a temporary occupancy permit. So folks could actually go up on the deck and do what people have been doing on that deck, watching the operations of the fish pier for decades now.
Tim, tell us, describe the deck for us, because this is a big undertaking, and it's apparently the construction is, while you say it's been delayed, it's also done at quite a high level.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, this is the deck faces the water. It's right above the working dock of the Chatham Commercial Fish Pier. The new deck holds over 180 people, which is much bigger than the previous deck. It's very, I was up there last week. It's very beautiful. It's well constructed. The town officials say that, despite the delays, the work has been really good and they're really happy with the finished product. But it shouldn't have taken, obviously, 18 months. And now the town and Shiaba, the contractor, are sort of trading blame back and forth for who's responsible for the delay. But the one thing that's clear is that there's going to be some negotiation over the final cost of this, which is estimated to be about $1.7 million, as well as whether those fines are actually collected or not. And Chiaba's chief financial officer, Michael Sheehan, told us, you know, if they can't get satisfaction from the town, they'll likely end up in court over this project.
Mm. That is Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle updating us on the Fish Pier Observation Deck back in business in Chatham. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Outdoor performances may be coming to the former Truro Air Force Station. Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner has the story and joins us now. Hi, Marianne.
Hey, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm fine.
Marianne, the Payomet Performing Arts Center is trying to make this happen, but it's kind of an unusual proposal here. Explain what it is they want to do out at the Truro Air Force Station, the former Truro Air Force Station.
Well, the Payomet Performing Arts Center, they've always had kind of a seasonal big tent performance space. It used to be right on Route 6, but now it's out at this the old military base in North Truro. And it's kind of like the Cape Cod Melody Tent. So it sounds airy, but it's really kind of a performance space with a lot of people packed in. So given the threat of the coronavirus, the leaders of the Payomet are started to look at this old, it's actually a softball field where the military people and civilians used to play softball. You know, during the heyday of the military station. And so they're going to basically take their usual performances. It's theater. It's, could be even circus acts, definitely music concerts, even poetry reading, and put it outdoors. And then in theory, people can drive their cars and they're assigned specific spaces for their cars. And then they're allowed to, the people who are attending are allowed to kind of either sit outside their car, they can sit in their car, but they're using this word, they're tethered to their car for, it's kind of like a drive-in concept, but it's not a drive-in movie, really. It's more like a drive-in performance.
This is posed because it doesn't really fit into any neat box. It's posed some difficulty for the permitting.
Right. They got a permit on Tuesday. It's an drive-in entertainment license from the town of Truro for two performances. And they've set some limits on that. It can be up to 100 people for each performance. But the leaders of Payomet, they're really thinking much bigger. So they're thinking more 80 to 90 cars and, you know, potentially like 360 people. But there's kind of a gray area in state law. So they, the town of Truro needs to talk to the State Department of Public Health and their own health agent to figure out really how to go forward.
And Marianne, for people who aren't familiar with the former Truro Air Force Station, just briefly tell us about that site. It's so unique to the Cape.
It is. It's really mysterious and kind of a cool place if you ever get a chance to go. The heyday was really like the 50s through the mid 80s, and it was what was considered a radar facility for the Cold War era. And it's like 110 acres. There were like 90 buildings out there at one point. It was really a small village, and there was like housing, all kinds of housing, commissary, a bowling alley, a movie theater, softball field, its own electric plant, and it's right on the bluff, just south of the Highland Light. So it's really, it's just an awesome kind of mysterious place it's owned by the Cape Cod National Seashore, and they've been trying for years to kind of reinvigorate it in some new way that's more arts, culture, science. So this is kind of one more little step in that direction, I think.
That is Marianne Bragg of the Provincetown Banner. Marianne, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Plenty of jobs, few workers. That's the headline on a story in the Martha's Vineyard Times this week that looks at a predicament for many island businesses. George Brennan wrote it, and he joins us now to talk about it. Hi, George.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
George, you start the story by saying that Stop and Shop would like to hire 100 new workers on the island, and other businesses are saying good luck with that. Tell us about the predicament the island finds itself in right now.
Yeah, a lot of this is exacerbated by the lack of foreign workers this summer. H-2B visas and J-1 visa workers aren't coming to the island this year, and they really do have a huge impact because there just aren't enough high school students and seniors, retired seniors who want to do part-time work to go around. You know, those are the people that are filling the jobs right now, but there are no more of them to jump in and work at Stop and Shop and Kronig's Market and Harborview Hotel and some of the restaurants on the island. So they're all desperate for workers. They're all competing for whoever's out there. There's an interesting anecdote in there from Steve Bernier. He's the owner of Kronig's, and he says he had someone in for a job interview. He wanted to hire the person, but the person had 5 other job opportunities. And as he put it, he took the person took the cushiest of those jobs. Mm. And working at the supermarket, it was not that job. Bernier, goes on to talk about how desperate he is for more help for his employees, just because, they've been working upwards of 60 hours a week. Of course, they're in a difficult position because they're frontline workers at a grocery store, seeing lots of people worried about their own health. Knock on wood, they haven't had anybody test positive for COVID-19 there. But they're taking precautions, of course. They have plexiglass up to protect workers. Everybody's wearing masks. So go ahead.
George, let me jump in and ask you. It's always been probably a summer predicament for the island that there's not enough workers. But this really is a different order of magnitude now.
It is, because the people are here. You know, we were wondering, would people come to the island? Well, some people are. I mean, it's not as many as a typical summer, but there's definitely the people who have second homes here are definitely coming. Some people are renting as they typically do for a week or 2 weeks at a time. So those people are here, but there aren't those workers to fill the jobs. So, we talked to a few different people, J.B. Blau, for instance, who's a restaurant owner, and he said, we can't get the food out any faster because of the lack of employees. So, people are going to have to be patient when they go out to eat, when they order curbside pickup. As I mentioned earlier today, you want to pack your patience along with your sunscreen when you come to the island.
I think when we've heard messaging around the restrictions on the visas for workers to come and that have kept a lot of workers away this year. But the messaging from the federal government was that there's so much unemployment that will sort of rise up to fill the workforce gap. That's not what's happening, though, on the island.
No, because there's a finite amount of people here, and people who are coming here to vacation certainly aren't going to jump in and work jobs, although some teenagers who do come with their families for the summer jump in into the job market, but there's just not enough of those to go around, never has been. Anybody who wants to work on the island can certainly find a job, and that's been the case any other summer as well, even with foreign workers here.
Hmm. George, I want to ask you about another story that you covered this week, along with some video, about an unusual animal in distress sighted along a vineyard beach. This is really something.
Yeah, they say a picture is worth 1,000 words. Well, a video, I don't know how many words a video is worth, but that really tells the story here. A couple of different people caught on film animal in distress. And it turns out, originally they thought it was a porpoise, but it turns out that it was this dwarf whale, experts now believe, that got struck by a great white, managed to get away, but nonetheless was flailing in the surf off Chappie, off East Beach there, and was caught on drone by one person, and another person got it on their cell phone, and just dramatic video of this, I guess it's a dwarf whale, you know, flailing away in the surf. The message here is the great white sharks have returned, and we all need to be mindful of that as we go to the beach this summer.
A dwarf sperm whale, which I didn't even know. I think I maybe had heard about, but I didn't really think about as being in our waters. And here one is along the beach, sort of flailing after it's been apparently attacked by a great white.
Right. That was new to me, too. And, you know, Greg Skomel, who's the shark expert, listeners have certainly heard his name over the years talk about great white sharks. He says, looking at the video footage, they can clearly see the teeth marks on this dwarf sperm whale, and they do believe that it's a great white shark that did it.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times, where you can find that video as well. George, thanks for joining us.
Nice talking to you, Steve. Take care.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker, broadcasting from my home office. Phase 3 of the governor's pandemic reopening plan got underway this week. Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times has that story. Hi, Cindy.
Good morning.
Cindy, some businesses that have not been able to open in a long time got to open their doors this week. Gyms, museums, movie theaters, you kind of round this up. Tell us about what this was like for some of these businesses.
Well, the gyms had a big response. I mean, not all their membership came back, but Sports Site and Sandwich expected to see 25 members on Monday. And then by, you know, sort of later in the afternoon, they'd seen 80. 13 people arrived between 5 and 6 a.m. for their workouts. I mean, I talked to people who said they really missed their routine. And it wasn't the same working out at home and on a machine in the basement. And, you know, people said, you know, they've gained weight, they got out of shape, and they liked the social aspect of being back in the gym.
They had to do some shuffling to accommodate these people, though, under the new rules.
They went to a lot of effort to accommodate people under the rules, under the new protocols. For instance, at the Mid-Cape Athletic Club, they had marked off every other fitness machine with blue tape so you couldn't use it. You know, that was to promote social distancing. If you can't be the state came up with rules the week before that said, hey, if you're 14 feet apart, you don't have to wear a mask. But then in some, for instance, Sports Site moved some of the more popular machines into one of their racquetball courts and spaced them out 14 feet apart, like an elliptical Stairmaster type of machine so that people could work out. Now, other people are still very nervous about this situation. I talked to a woman from Sandwich who said that she's going to wait a bit to return to her gym. She's just going to see how it goes and let the staff kind of get used to it. There's a lot of sanitizing going on. People are supposed to wear masks, of course, I've been told that people are struggling to breathe and they can, you know, pull their mask down, but it's sort of other people are worried about, you know, breathing that common air, you know what I mean, being exposed to that way. So there's still a lot of gym goers out there who are like thrilled to be back and they love the social aspects of it, but gyms are still going to continue with outdoor classes and they're going to continue with online classes too. And the YMCA is not opening until this coming Monday.
Tell us about some of the other businesses that got to reopen. Museums and movie theaters both fell under this phase 3 reopening.
Yeah, and Heritage Movie Theater and Sandwich did reopen, and they had actually, you know, been showing movies outside. You know, they did a little drive-in against one of their walls, which is white, painted white, and have been doing that. But they decided to reopen, and they had marked off every other. I went there, and they had marked off every other row, and they're only allowing 25 people. That's a state rule: 25 people per indoor space. It's either 8 people per 1,000 square feet, or a maximum of 25 people in an enclosed space like that. So when I was there, there was like no one there during the day too, not at night. But a number of movie theaters are waiting. They're waiting for more guidance. They're waiting to, they just don't feel comfortable with opening up yet. But and then also museums are allowed to open, and the Cape Cod Museum of Art is scheduled to open to the public tomorrow. The Cahoon Museum in Kootenai will not be opening until August 1st. But things are opening back up again. And like movie theaters seem to be taking it kind of slowly there in Sandwich, but people, I think, you know, besides children missing school, I think what people miss the most is, it seems their workout routines, you know what I mean? It's a lifestyle for a lot of people. It's socialization. Mm-hmm. It feels like getting back to normal for people. But then on the other hand, there's still some concern about, like, you know, how is this going to work out? Are people really going to take their, keep their distance? Are they, you know, going to wear their masks? You know, there's, so some people are kind of holding back to see, let's see how this goes. You know what I mean?
Mm. We have to relearn how to go to the gym in these new times. Cindy McCormick.
You have to go to the gym.
Yes. Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
We are going to speak now with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. Noah, are you there with us?
Hi.
Noah, you covered the Steamship Authority this week. It had gone through a period of time in which it seemed like they were really up against it in terms of finances with the pandemic. Some news happened over the last week that gave them a sense of hope. Explain what's been going on.
Yeah, so this was kind of a surprise, but what happened on Thursday was that the state Senate passed an amendment to the fiscal year 2020 budget. And what the amendment does is it basically indemnifies any of the steamship support communities. So that's on the Cape, that's Falmouth, Hyannis, and then it's also New Bedford, and then, of course, the two islands, Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, from having to shoulder any of the Steamship Authority's financial operating deficit burden, and it basically passes that burden on to the state. And the reason that's important is that it could potentially save the port communities millions of dollars, because the steamship was looking at a budget deficit that was, I think, like even the rosiest prediction was somewhere in the $20 to $30 million range. And that's a lot for towns that were already cash strapped.
Now, this is really a tale of political maneuvering. Take us back a little bit to the early days of the pandemic and explain how this all came about so that we've gotten to this point here.
Yeah, exactly. I think political maneuvering is a good way to put it. This took a bunch of steps, and there were a lot of twists and turns along the way, and I don't think it was ever predetermined that this was going to be sort of the solution for the port communities. But basically what happened was back in April, ridership just totally plummeted because of the pandemic, and the steamship is one of the only, if not, I believe, the only federal or transportation agencies that doesn't get any sort of state or federal funding. They're totally a fare box funded ferry service. So that just makes them really susceptible to declines in ridership. And when that happened, the sort of financial crisis, it snowballed really quickly. And the general manager of the steamship, Bob Davis, sent this urgent letter to Governor Baker asking for help. And the initial answer was pretty much no. I think Governor Baker was asked.
Governor, yeah. He seemed to like want to wash his hands of the whole thing very quickly.
Totally, totally. It was like, let's pass the buck on to the federal level. And, you know, I think some of that, according to the steamship general manager, was a little bit of confusion about how the steamship is regulated. I mean, it is kind of this esoteric, you know, of course, for us out here, it's crucial and important, and as they call it, a lifeline. But for a lot of people at the upper level of state government and the federal government, it's like, well, what? This isn't really something we know a whole lot about. So that all kind of had to happen. And eventually what happened was the federal government did help with the steamship. They gave them enough money to get through the summer, but the prospect of a budget shortfall still existed. And so what happened was the state, the representative Julian Sear, who is the state senator for many part of the Cape and the Islands, and Representative Dylan Fernandez, they sort of brokered these conversations with the Executive Office of Administration and Finance, which is this sort of wonky branch of the Baker administration focused on public policy. And they said, hey, you know, we're still going to need help because the port communities are in trouble. And they came up with this idea of bailing out the steamship, giving them a pot of money. None of that really caught on. And then when the budget hearing came, Senator Sear had the idea of, hey, let's sort of flip the script and say, instead of bailing out the steamship, which, you know, has its own sort of optics problems, let's try and help the port communities. And that's how they came up with the idea of this budget amendment. But it was really sort of last minute. And, you know, they've been working for months to try and figure this out. But and the fact that something kind of came of it this way was sort of a surprise and a good one for the poor communities. It was exciting to hear about. But of course, it's not done. And,
yes, I was going to say nobody's clapping themselves on the back just yet because it's not done till the state signs off on all of this.
Right. Exactly.
When you talk about the poor communities, you're talking about not just on the Vineyard, but you know, New Bedford, Falmouth, Hyannis, right, are the other port communities who would potentially be on the hook for millions of dollars if the state, right, does not come through on this.
Right, exactly. The way it's broken down is actually this funky system where New Bedford, Hyannis, and Falmouth all would be responsible for 10% of the deficit. And the reason this is why even what would happen is that the steamship's charter, which goes back to the 60s, says that if the boat line does run a deficit, which it hasn't done in a very long time, I think like half a century, then the state has to pay it back, then they can sort of, I think basically the word they use is they assess the towns. Mm-hmm. And Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard are 35% each. So it's more for Nantucket and Martha's Vineyard, but it does. It impacts the entire region when something like this happens. Of course, now the bill needs to get reconciled in the House, and it still needs to get a signature from Governor Baker. But it seems like talking to Senator Sear and the future general manager that they're hopeful that it'll happen.
It's Noah Asimo of the Vineyard Gazette with the story. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
The state legislature plans to end its formal lawmaking session at the end of the month, even though we're in a pandemic. WCAI's Catherine Iden talked with State House reporter Mike Dean for a look at what the next few weeks may include on Beacon Hill. Here's the conversation.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning, Catherine.
We know that much of Beacon Hill's attention has been taking up with legislative responses to the pandemic and also calls for police reform. But there are still quite a few issues from what we'll call the before times that need to be resolved. Is there going to be time for that?
Yeah, we don't know. The expectations have been lowered really across the board as far as lawmakers being responsible for, you know, what they said was urgent before the pandemic struck. Of course, priorities have shifted for everyone in government, everyone in the United States pretty much. So it's starting to shake out now, you know, what is going to come back from, you know, from the back burner, get promoted back into something that will be dealt with, or what just gets, you know, shoveled off until next year and the next session. And I think the biggest question lawmakers had before the pandemic struck was what to do about transportation taxes. Obviously, the House passed a major tax hike bill. The Senate never took it up. And so we're still waiting. Does the Senate want to do something this year? Do they want to wait until after the fiscal impact of the pandemic is known before doing a tax bill? We don't know, and time is running out on that one. But, you know, there's all sorts of other issues that were brought up as urgent before that are now kind of being reshaped by COVID and the pandemic. Things like rent control. There was a huge movement to bring rent control back to cities and towns that wanted to institute a system like that. Now a lot of that oxygen is being taken up by stopping people from being foreclosed and evicted upon during the pandemic. So a lot of the kind of housing energy reshaped itself away from rent control and into eviction protection.
What about police reform? The governor came out with some proposals a few weeks ago, and the Senate has its own proposal. What would the Senate like to see happen?
The Senate would like to see everything happen. This bill is enormous. It is as broad a stroke as you can really fit into one bill. And it's being described as really the first step of systemic change when it comes to the way communities are policed in Massachusetts. It's got basically everything that the governor included in his bill, which would set up a process to accredit police and then have that accreditation taken away if they violate standards, and then you know, establish new standards of training, things like that. But the Senate goes so much further expanding it. They create a new kind of autonomous state committee that would investigate instances, you know, accusations of police abuse or discrimination. That would be pretty public facing with civilian overview. And there would actually also be a website where people could look up police officers that they have encounters with and look at their records, what training they've received, if there have been any kind of dings on their record when it comes to racial interaction or abuse of authority. Those types of stuff would be public under the Senate bill. And there's a thousand other little bits and pieces where it makes progressive steps and progressive policy.
Has the House issued anything formal? I know there's been talk and ideas put forth.
Yeah, the House presented their bill a few weeks ago. I believe it still remains to be taken up. So we haven't seen how the House would like to amend that bill, but there's definitely proposals are on the floor. And so we kind of get a sense of what leadership wants to do, at least what the members want to do and how they're going to shift it through the amendment process when they take up the bills and then compromise on a final bill remains to be seen.
What's the feeling like on Beacon Hill? Will they actually get this done since there are so many agenda items for them in the next couple of weeks?
It definitely seems like the policing bill, some kind of bill to address Black Lives Matter movement and things like that, will get done. We're not sure exactly the final form, whether it will be on the more conservative reform side like Charlie Baker is offering or on the extreme systemic reform side that the House is doing. It will likely end up somewhere in the middle. It'll probably be something palatable for the governor to sign. They're running out of time to force override votes if the governor does decide to veto any of this legislation. So that is something that I think would be very embarrassing for the legislature to fail to pass something on the police, something on police reform this session. That means this month before July 31st when they recess for the rest of the year. There's also a number of other things having to do with the COVID crisis. A lot of the financial issues are things that I think the leaders up here would rather deal with on their own after the rest of the members go home, things that can get done in informal session, as they're called, where the legislature does continue to meet on quote-unquote non-controversial items, but they don't require big roll call votes of the entire chambers to get it done. That might be seen as a more efficient, if less transparent, way to manage the fiscal impact of the crisis as we kind of go into a very, very dodgy tax year.
So you foresee another kind of temporary bill to get them through budget-wise before they get something hammered out that looks at the year more in total?
Yeah, them being this far behind on a budget is not new. I believe and they've only really passed a budget on time once or twice in the last decade or so. So there's really no real expectation of getting the budget done on time. Of course, now it is significantly late, and there's no sign of it coming. So not only are they late, they don't really have an expectation that's going to happen. So they are doing these one-month spending bills, which is basically a level fund from last year to keep state government open and keep passing those month by month while working on an annual budget that we might see potentially in the fall at this point. It looks like folks are looking at what this new July tax filing deadline could mean. When those income tax numbers come in, the state budget writers will have a better idea of how much money the state's going to have to spend, and then maybe they can put together an annual budget bill.
Would they do that in informal session, or are they coming back into regular formal sessions in the fall?
Well, technically, they should come back to formal sessions. Now that they have these online formal sessions where only a handful of members need to be in the chamber, they could theoretically take a roll call vote into the fall. They don't like to do that. They like to recess on July 31st and be done with it, and then only extremely routine and non-controversial items are taken up after that. However, when it comes to the budget, that is something that year after year they've dipped past their deadline to get a final version done, so they could come back and do something like that. And again, because they are now legally authorized to meet virtually, that is something they could push through without too much of a problem.
All right, so we'll be keeping an eye on quite a few different things in the coming weeks before they break. That is WCAI State House reporter Mike D. And Mike, thanks a lot.
Great to be with you.
And that is WCAI's Catherine Iden speaking with Mike Dean up at the State House. That's our show for today. I want to thank my guests, WCAI's Jeanette Barnes and Eve Zuckoff, Josh Balling at the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Mary Ann Bragg at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, Cindy McCormick at the Cape Cod Times. We spoke with Noah Asimo at the Vineyard Gazette. Big thanks to Dan Treidel back at the studio for making all the moves quickly and quietly that keep the whole show together. From my home in Woods Hole, I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.